La integrante del Comité por la Libertad de Milagro Sala, Estela Díaz, explicó que la responsabilidad es del Gobierno Nacional.
La verdad que parece que la justicia no actuó de manera independiente, y cuando hablamos de que hay una prisión arbitraria e ilegal, la está cometiendo la justicia de Jujuy por injerencia del Poder Ejecutivo jujeño y con la complicidad del Nacional, porque hace meses que Macri tiene una resolución de Naciones Unidas que incumple. Así que la verdad que no hay independencia de la justicia y el Gobierno Nacional no se puede hacer el desentendido. Nosotros somos un Estado federal, pero cuando asumimos compromisos internacionales los asume el Estado Nacional y se debe ser garante de su cumplimiento. Por eso la CIDH no se dirige a la justicia de Jujuy ni al gobernador de Jujuy, se dirige al Gobierno Nacional. Y le plantea al Gobierno Nacional que esta medida cautelar, como máximo en 15 días, le debe informar qué pasos dio para cumplirla.
La petición que se le presentó al presidente expresa que el Estado argentino debe poner fin a las violaciones a los derechos humanos y asumir el firme compromiso de no utilizar nunca más el encarcelamiento arbitrario como forma de persecución, disciplinamiento y represión de la disidencia política. Recordemos que la Organización de las Naciones Unidas, a través de su grupo de trabajo sobre detenciones arbitrarias, consideró que la detención de Milagro Sala es arbitraria y exigió su liberación. También la Organización de Estados Americanos, la OEA, pidió en noviembre pasado la libertad de Milagro Sala mediante un comunicado de su secretario general Luis Almagro. El pedido más reciente, como ya lo informamos, lo hizo la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, que depende de la OEA y que, mediante una medida cautelar, pidió el arresto domiciliario o la libertad controlada electrónicamente para la dirigente social y parlamentaria del Mercosur, Milagro Sala. El presidente del Centro de Estudios Legales y Sociales, Horacio Verbitsky, recalcó que esta última resolución marca que Milagro Sala está presa por ser opositora al gobernador Gerardo Morales. Así lo expresaba en la conferencia de prensa realizada en Plaza de Mayo, luego de la presentación del petitorio al presidente.
La resolución de la Comisión Interamericana dice con todas las letras que Milagro está perseguida por ser una líder social, por ser mujer, por ser indígena y por ser opositora al gobierno de la provincia. No es cierto, como dice el gobierno de la provincia, que ella esté detenida por actos de corrupción. La comisión dice con toda claridad de qué se trata. Y además pide, en forma nítida, en el párrafo 45 que leyó Eli, la libertad inmediata de Milagro.
Varios países de Europa y de América Latina, incluyendo España y México, se han sumado a los Estados Unidos para amenazar a Venezuela por haberse atrevido a permitir que el pueblo practique la libertad soberana de votar por una asamblea constituyente. Vladimir Adrianza es un reconocido analista internacional con un gran dominio en el mundo de la energía y geopolítica. Él asegura que hoy día se libra la Cuarta Guerra Mundial, que empezó hace poco y que la protagoniza una fuerza tripolar.
Ese mundo tripolar hoy en día tiene todo un espectro a nivel internacional que abarca todos los continentes del planeta. Y ese hecho particularmente con respecto al caso de Venezuela, Venezuela ha sido punta de lanza en el tiempo del presidente Hugo Chávez para constituir una suerte de bloque suramericano, el cual por las acciones de los Estados Unidos y la derecha se ha visto a menos, específicamente por el hecho de que Estados Unidos ha influido en destruir algo que el presidente Chávez conformó, que es el hecho de lo que él llamó el eje Caracas-Brasilia-Buenos Aires. De Brasilia ya sabemos lo que ha pasado con la presidencia de Dilma Rousseff y el presidente de facto, Michel Temer, y todo el desorden que han creado ahí, entre otras cosas, para golpear a los BRICS. En el caso de Argentina, está la política de un presidente que, entre otras cosas, ha mostrado su total sumisión a lo que son los intereses económicos internacionales y políticos y geopolíticos de los Estados Unidos, y que hoy en día resulta ser un país que ha accionado, su gobierno ha accionado en contra de Venezuela, pese a todos los apoyos que recibió la Argentina en los tiempos de los Kirchner para salir de la inmensa crisis que tuvo de parte de Venezuela, específicamente con el presidente Hugo Chávez. Y si vamos a ver el resto del continente, podemos verlo en términos de lo que Kuczynski, el presidente del Perú, definió a América Latina algo así como, Sudamérica era algo así como un perro echado, y el único que no era un perro echado era Venezuela, por lo que él prácticamente dijo, que era lo único que estaba diferente al contexto de América Latina, y que en ese contexto ellos tenían un plan para de alguna manera lograr quebrar la circunstancia que existe aquí en Venezuela y ponerla prácticamente alineada a lo que es la geopolítica de los Estados Unidos.
La situación en Venezuela, dice, refleja la lucha de la doctrina de Monroe y la doctrina anticolonial bolivariana, que nació como una medida protectora contra potencias coloniales.
Toda esa situación la estamos viviendo. El presidente Chávez, todos sabemos que él abogó, y en el plan de la patria lo dice, por un mundo multipolar para lograr colocar a la América Latina en ese contexto. Lula también en alguna oportunidad dijo que ninguno de los países de América Latina tenían una viabilidad en el tiempo si no era juntos y trabajando en equipo. Entonces, en esta circunstancia en la que estamos ahora, simplemente se pone sobre el tapete un conjunto de elementos, y ese conjunto de elementos están signados por acciones en lo internacional, en el cual hoy en día, específicamente los Estados Unidos con respecto a Venezuela, se está desarrollando toda una arremetida para lograr derribar no solamente el gobierno del presidente Nicolás Maduro Moro, sino dejar de lado la constitución de la República Bolivariana de Venezuela como mecanismo que impide la acción libérrima de los intereses transnacionales sobre nuestro país, específicamente en las materias primas estratégicas. Pero es que no solamente es en el marco de las materias primas estratégicas, sino también en el marco de que durante 200 años se ha librado en el continente americano una confrontación entre dos doctrinas, la doctrina Monroe y la doctrina bolivariana. La doctrina Monroe, por supuesto, la de América para los americanos, entiéndose muy entendida del inicio del siglo XX como para los estadounidenses, donde realmente la geopolítica de Estados Unidos hacia el continente ha sido una política de dominación de todos sus aspectos, y la doctrina bolivariana, que es una doctrina que planteó prácticamente el hacer una nación sudamericana muy fuerte, que en pocas palabras planteaba eso del equilibrio del universo, o sea, una potencia fuerte que fuera en ese entonces capaz de frenar, de hacerle frente, mejor dicho, a las pretensiones coloniales dominantes de las potencias de Europa y de las recientes potencias, como fue al final del siglo XIX, principio del XX, Estados Unidos.
Arianza señala que la administración de Donald Trump busca el retorno de industrias a la Unión Americana y el acceso a grandes cantidades de energía.
Esa postura ha estado enfrentada durante todos estos tiempos, y indiscutiblemente eso representa un escollo en el camino para lo que sigue siendo la política de los Estados Unidos, que nos sigue viendo a nosotros como si fueran su patio trasero. Y más hoy en día, cuando estamos hablando de un presidente republicano, como el caso de Donald Trump, que sus dos lemas principales son America First y Make America Great Again. Y entonces, en el marco de Make America Great Again, para poder impulsar ese aparato industrial de los Estados Unidos, requiere, entre otras cosas, de recursos naturales cerca de su frontera, y recursos naturales que son fundamentales, como el caso concreto del petróleo, porque la seguridad nacional de los Estados Unidos está directamente relacionada con lo que es su seguridad energética. En el caso concreto del Medio Oriente, le acaba de hacer un convenio con Arabia Saudí que arranca en la venta de 110 mil millones de dólares en armamento, que puede ser expandible, depende de la fuente que consultemos, a 330 mil o a 660 mil millones de dólares en armamento. Él no se pregunta para qué, y simplemente para relanzar el complejo militar industrial de los Estados Unidos como materia, como medio para sacar a ese país de la recesión, pero creando problemas en el Medio Oriente, justamente con una estrategia muy parecida a la que sucedía en épocas de la Guerra Fría, con aquello del llamado arco de contención de la Unión Soviética, que se creó alrededor de todo el Medio Oriente.
Los planes de la oligarquía norteamericana, dice, se enfocan en la destrucción de Irán, pero para llegar allí, primero deben asegurar el control de Siria y de Venezuela.
Cuando nosotros analizamos la situación de Siria, lo que ha pasado en Siria, vemos que detrás del problema de Siria simplemente fue el hecho de que, por una parte, Arabia Saudí quería pasar un oleoducto a través de Siria, y por otra parte, los israelíes, en su proceso de ocupación del territorio que es Palestina, le interesaba ponerle la mano, le interesa poner la mano a toda una serie de yacimientos de gas y de petróleo que están en lo que se llama en la cuenca del Levante. y en esa cuenca del Levante, indiscutiblemente existen un conjunto de yacimientos que son, por un lado, de interés de los israelíes, y por otro lado, en el caso del paso del petróleo, de Arabia Saudí. Pero ¿por qué a Arabia Saudí le interesa? Fíjate las implicaciones geopolíticas con respecto al Medio Oriente que tiene esto. ¿Cuál es el principal argumento? La yugular del petróleo, el estrecho de Hormuz. ¿Cuál es la forma de pasarle por encima a esa carta que podría tener Irán para evitar que lo ataquen? Creando un oleoducto que pasara por Siria y que colocara el petróleo en el mar Mediterráneo. A eso fue lo que se opuso Bashar al-Assad, y por eso ya tiene 6 años en guerra. El país ha perdido 4 millones de personas, ha quedado totalmente destruido y todavía el conflicto no está debidamente solucionado. Pero es que ese elemento también es de interés de los Estados Unidos. ¿Por qué? Porque al pasar por ese territorio, ese oleoducto, para poder transferir buena parte de lo que se produce en la península arábiga hacia el mar Mediterráneo, le daría la posibilidad a ellos de atacar posteriormente a Irán.
Era Vladimir Adrianza, un reconocido analista internacional con un gran dominio en el mundo de la energía, seguridad, geoeconomía y geopolítica, hablando ante el micrófono de Walter Martínez. Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de Venezolana de Televisión, de RT, del colectivo Más Voces, la red Farco, Telesur, Radio Naciones Unidas y el diario La Jornada. En nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide de tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Vela. Gracias por acompañarnos.
This is Diane Patterson. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101freakradio.org.
And you are tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org on your computer, and broadcasting at you soon. We hope to acquire a studio. I'm Robert Norris. Coming up next, it's Bathrobes Piers Broadsides, the August 3rd, 2017 edition. Stay tuned.
They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Press your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't. Song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
Well, we may have a few songs of social significance this evening with our show, mostly from the distant past, but perhaps not so distant with a few of them. There is not really a chance to call in yet because we don't have a studio, but if you have any comments to make, and actually I got a few during the last show. I was surprised last Sunday when I did the longer morning show. Thank you, callers, for letting me know that you enjoyed the show or that you thought it was worth listening to. That's something that is good feedback because it encourages me to continue doing this or possibly to find someone who might be interested in doing it. I haven't really begun that kind of a search yet. But the number to call if you have any comments or thoughts is 423-4833. 423-4833 is also a message line for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which is a small group that meets every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa Cafe next to the bike church and bats around grievances and complaints that we might be able to clarify for the public that are actually real concerns about civil rights violations in Santa Cruz, and particularly around poor and homeless people. You're welcome to come. It happens, as I say, 11 o'clock every Wednesday, and you can get in touch if you want to help deal with civil rights issues, whether it's the sleeping ban, criminalization of poor people simply being in public spaces, abusive process at city council, police brutality generally. Get in touch, 423-4833. So I'm getting out a bit more than I was in the last couple months, and I have some interviews I kind of want to catch up with, so I'm going to put those on and probably interrupt them with various comments, some rude, some educational, who knows. That's what I often do with these interviews, to kind of clarify both my opinions and what I think is actually happening around town, and what I would encourage people in the community to consider doing to deal with some of these issues, as if I knew. And let's go back to some interviews at a Food Not Bombs feeding session or gathering session. It happens twice a week, Saturday and Sunday. It usually starts around 4, sometimes earlier at 3. There was a traditional forbidden fence decorating session around the downtown post office. The fence, as you may remember, was put up to deter homeless sleepers from disturbing the building at night with their snores and upsetting neighbors a block or two away looking out their windows who just can't stand the sight of poor people in visible places in their downtown area. Happens every Saturday and Sunday. Encourage people to go down there and volunteer because Food Not Bombs, though it is to some extent often seen like more of a charity organization than a political activist organization, it has been very active in the Freedom Sleepers movement, although that movement now seems to have either gone into hibernation or perhaps, well, disappeared under repression from police, Parks and Rec rangers, and first alarm security thugs at City Hall. It was a movement to demand that homeless people have the right to sleep somewhere legally at night, which they currently don't, in a city which has zero shelter, really, other than signing up for waiting lists, leaving 1,500 to 2,000 people outside. Figures differ, but it's more than 1,000. That's a lot of folks. And people are getting tickets for simply being in public places. Some voices from the street from some of those folks.
Hey, Frank.
Make a note of this. Well, I guess it's been recording. We're talking with
Frank Joseph Lopez.
And Frank,
VIP.
What's the word from the wheelchair?
Yeah. Long live the homeless. And leave peace. Leave us alone. Please, please, speak alone.
Here,
I'll occupy right here.
I hear you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we're talking.
Told you about that when they would let me take my meds. That was like...
I vaguely remember, but just refresh my memory. We're talking with...
Sharon.
And Sharon, you say you talked already about having filed some complaints about Rangers?
Yes. Right across from City Hall is the Rangers office. Okay, that law that states that you cannot sit on the wall is bogus. There's a way around it. People stand on top of the wall. They would not let me take my seizure meds. And I was having a grandma seizure. He goes, if you sit on that wall, I'm giving you a ticket. I walked right across the street. I said, I used to work with you fuckers. I know where you're off. I said, I want complaint forms. And so he is now behind a desk, and he is the head ranger here of Santa Cruz.
What's his name?
I can't remember his name, but he's a really tall, Hawaiian-looking like one, heavyset kid. That's why he's at City Hall. He's not allowed to harass us over there anymore.
Gotcha.
But it's really hard to tell whether Sharon is accurate in describing experiences for others, although she may well be quite accurately describing her own experiences. What I've found is that police have often used a very broad law in the city code, which is an infraction ordinance, which says you cannot use public property in such a way for which it was neither, customarily used or originally designed. And the low-lying cement walls or stone walls around City Hall, which people sit on regularly all the time, Rangers told people sitting there as they stepped up pressure on homeless people, freedom sleepers, and then the week-long survival sleepers, as I call those who were sleeping there every night once the shelters closed in April, to leave or get a ticket. They would use that kind of phraseology, even though what they were doing was saying you can't sit on the wall, which you can because people do sit there customarily, and it's simply not the case. However, if you try standing on the wall, they will claim, people don't customarily stand there, and therefore we can cite you for it. The notion that you give a class of people with uniforms and sort of an organized system of record keeping and well-paid, or at least paid, I don't know how well-paid, it's not really fair to say that, but at least getting a salary for running around harassing people in this way is dangerous insofar as it simply encourages people who are in these positions to be abusive, but it also encourages those who can use them to be abusive. That is to say, the politicians like Martine Bernal, the city manager, the most powerful city official, to essentially tell them to go out there and harass homeless people. Initially, a couple years ago, with Klieg lights and yellow tape and loud, smelly, and possibly toxic to those who have asthma and other conditions, generators that were generating at night to create these high-power lights that Bernal kept on for a month or two, and then turning to other things like harassment raids at midnight. It's a dangerous thing when politicians have the power to use people with the power to use force, and people who are supposedly backed up by a system of so-called laws, which actually, of course, no one in this community had any say over, at least not recently. And even if they did, they only did so in the most indirect way, where the real power came from downtown merchants, conservative residents, developers, real estate people, staff members who somehow have the notion that they have a right to create a little oasis of peace and calm for their work situation, regardless of how miserable their police are making poor and homeless people outside. Anyway, that was Sharon talking about the issue for her. It is true that the Parks and Rec Department, for those who want to go and give them a piece of their mind, is right across from City Hall along Church Street next to the Civic Auditorium. people can go there. It's also the place to go if you want to file an appeal on a stay-away order, which was given to you by a police officer who just said, oh, we caught you sleeping in a park after dark, therefore now you can't be there for 24 hours, or if it's the second time for a week, or the third time for a month, as though the public spaces were somehow their booty and their property to divide and deal with as they wish. There's a really phony appeal process, but I'm encouraging people to get together and essentially appeal stay-away orders. These are orders that are given short of court. You don't even get to go to court. You get a ticket, which you have to fight in court, which may cost you a couple $100. But the stay-away order is something short of court that infringes on your liberty with no court process whatsoever, just on the basis of the say-so of the officer that he decided he was going to give you a citation. Doesn't he have to prove the citation was justified? Because he gives you the stay-away order before the citation even reaches court. People more interested in this and in fighting this whole illegal process can give me a call at 423-4833.
If he's harassing people over there, they're to walk where the convention center is, right next to the convention center, one building over, as their main office.
Parks and Rec, yeah.
And file a complaint. They say keep filing them against him if he starts harassing you guys.
Good suggestion. Thank you, Sharon. We've been talking with...
Sharon.
Thank you, Sharon. In the street, talking to a man with a camera and a tripod and, sadly, an American flag. What's your name, sir? Wes White. And, Wes, what are you doing with this tripod here at the Food Not Bombs now?
Oh, well, you know, I would have enjoyed interviewing you. But apparently the recorder's on the other foot right now, on the other hand.
Well, we can do dueling recorders. Yeah.
Right? Wouldn't that be fun?
I'm about to run out of steam, though, so is there anything that's happened in the last week other than the largely inaudible recording you made of the homeless ACLU forum,
which
it's hard for me to hear. Maybe my hearing is going bad. You were in the back of the room. They weren't very good, no.
What I'm referring to, you can actually find online. You can probably hear it if you turn up the volume and listen carefully. This is an event sponsored by our local ACLU about, believe it or not, homeless civil rights. And that's a good thing, of course. Although the issues that were discussed 2 years before at a similar forum with a similar cast, although not sponsored by the ACLU locally. And the reason the ACLU is sponsoring it is because Abby Samuels, at Steve Plaich's suggestion, became a member of the board of directors of the ACLU along with a few other associates, and then encouraged the ACLU board to at least look like it was concerned with these issues. Abby is concerned with these issues, spends a great deal of time trying to defend people, and she was out there sleeping quite regularly and videoing police misbehavior on the Freedom Sleepers Tuesday nights before the situation came to what appears to be an end, although there is even there's some controversy about that. At the last Huff meeting yesterday, the Homeless United meeting, there were a couple people who said that they had heard reports that they believe that people did sleep overnight two nights ago, Tuesday night, which would have been Freedom Sleep Out 108. Although I believe there was also food served by Food Not Bombs activist Tyler Joe Schultz of India Joe's, and I don't know about coffee in the morning, but there is still some semblance or remnants of support happening there. People just don't want to give up the fight in that particular location, though the city has cracked down. And, of course, if you're a follower of guerrilla warfare tactics, when the enemy advances, you retreat. When the enemy retreats, you advance, yada, yada, yada. I'm not much of a guerrilla war strategist or military guy, but I can understand that's not necessarily a bad strategy. There's also other strategies which involve continuing high-profile visibility in one place in order to give people a sort of a rallying point. But unfortunately, the liberal community and even the radical community has never really rallied in numbers or in regular support to the Freedom Sleepers. I think they have, to some extent, to Food Not Bombs. And in any case, what the ACLU forum that Wes White, the videographer that we just heard at the Food Not Bombs rally, where this audio was taken, that he videoed, and is you can available on YouTube. Just go to look for Wes White video ACLU Santa Cruz, browse around, and you'll find it. It's the point was to encourage homeless people to sign up to initiate an injunction lawsuit that seeks both damages and redress and an end, an injunction, that is to say, a ban on the city police and other criminal conspiracy agencies operating under the color of law from harassing homeless people in public spaces, particularly around the issue of sleeping, where there are no facilities in Santa Cruz for homeless people to sleep. And, of course, the message is hide out or get out, as I've said many a time on this show. But as I also mentioned before, this issue of an injunctive lawsuit is one that the National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty's Tristia Bauman, who spoke both 2 years ago at a Food Not Bombs rally or dinner, and here again at this dinner or this forum, which Wes White videoed, and you can see online, it didn't go anywhere, really. And this time there is some hope that since Tristia is in the neighborhood, kind of, in the South Bay, I believe, and that more determined activists like Abby, who aren't spreading their time around with board of directorships like Steve Plaich was, may be more successful. Abby, I think, has a hard job already working with Keith McHenry to put out the twice-weekly Food Not Bombs meal, which is not just a charity, but is also a place where people gather, where homeless people serve themselves food, where political literature is available, again, 4 to 6 every Saturday and Sunday at the main post office.
Volume, though. Well, I know that you have also been cooking up suggestions of rules, of procedures for folks in Salinas, of homeless folks to use. Has that been successful?
Well, actually, you know, what I was thinking of was trying to get Andrea Pritchett there from Berkeley Cop Watch, and she mentioned Mike Zant, which would be awesome, too.
You mean Andrea, the go-to-your city council, or get an injunction Pritchard? That's the Andrea you're talking about?
Oh, I guess, yeah. She was pretty...
She was a very, very dynamic speaker, yeah. And she's a dynamic organizer of Cop Watch. But, and she's even a street activist. There's no question about that. But those suggestions are likely to get you action sometime, never.
Huh. Okay, well, you know, I guess
may have seen in Salinas.
You know, things have taken a pretty good turn in the last couple of years. I mean, the county is starting to become a little more responsible, at least on the face of it.
Tell me about their accomplishments.
Last week they announced that they were going to enter into a contract for a year-round shelter that can hold 100 people.
Out of how many people in Salinas who are outside?
Yes, but out of
oh, I just wondered. I'm not challenging you. I'm asking you.
Yeah, but out of where they were, they only had 50 to 70 people, so now they're going to do 100. So that's an improvement. Yeah, there's over 700, at least 800, the point-in-time count. I think said over 3,000 in Monterey County. And I don't know.
Town has been the place, the area.
The problem is when you praise authorities for doing these incremental, minuscule baby steps, an improvement of 20 when the need is for 700 is kind of a joke to the majority of people who are there. And it also misrepresents what's really going on to people who are watching, who are trying to get some understanding of the situation and how to evaluate the worth and the progress of the politicians around this issue. It's not really much progress at all. And so to talk about it in a positive way, to me, is kind of doing a disservice in a way. it's misreading it. I understand some of the strategy. You want the politicians to pay attention to you. You don't want to appear negative to the community. You know, we want to have a feel-good situation. Everything is getting better, and it's going to be better step by step. It's what I would call the Micah Posner approach that he was using. In other words, rather than taking a definitive stand and saying, how are things really? What's the real situation? What are the real needs? And how does that compare with what is actually being done or proposed to be done? You soft soap the politicians, or you at least try to put it in a light which maybe encourages activists not to roll over and play dead and give up in despair and commit suicide. I mean, I kind of understand that too. But to me, it's hard going down.
Yeah, near City Hall in Salinas, where people were sleeping a couple years ago, next to Dorothy's place.
It's growing again.
Oh, and is that now, when I was there a couple months ago, that was resuming sleeping. Is that still happening?
Yeah, there's people up and down there. There's sweeps that happen a lot. There's a lot of belligerence that happens. You know, there's discretion. I brought that up to the county this week with the city being there as well, the mayor. So a lot of people were nervous while I was talking about it. The board chamber supervisors looking, making eyeballs, darting over to the mayor. Uh-oh, he said it. He said it. You know, so I think they're getting more nervous, and that I think is the biggest piece.
And how many of your minions did you bring with you?
Well, we had about five different people, even an 11-year-old kid, and they gave a lot of.
And we're talking about two different things. One of them is the essentially the Trumpville, if you will, that has been set up to describe essentially a slum tent encampment that people are just surviving in, a survival city that has been set up about a block from Salinas City Hall in what is called the Chinatown area, which is next to a sort of a couple of social service buildings, I would say somewhat token social service buildings, but do provide some services, one of them called Dorothy's Place. And then the Board of Supervisors, which Wes has been taking people to, it runs the county of, I guess it's Monterey, Monterey County, the county directly to the south of Santa Cruz County, and which includes the largest city and the county seat is Salinas, I believe. Could be Monterey being the county seat, I'm not sure, but Salinas, I think, is bigger than Monterey. And he takes people to the Board of Supervisors to demand services, justice, redress of grievances, and that's all very well, and that's as proposed by activists, even more radical activists like Andrea Pritchard of Berkeley Copwatch, apparently. If you want to hear her speech, you can go again online and look at the ACLU's houselessness forum, I think it's called, of a couple of weeks ago that Wes videoed.
About five different people, I guess. Yeah, and you know, they got up and talked. Probably about two or three, but you know, it's hard to get working people to there, and if they're like, you've already got that attitude, so why wouldn't people on the street already have that attitude as well? Of like, what I say doesn't matter, but it does. Your voice is very strong. Your voice is very powerful.
Well, I think one's voice matters, but it also depends on who you speak to, how you spend your time speaking, and what institutions you put your confidence in.
Okay, but you know, you have to get along with other people, and society is no different. Public corporate is no different. As a self-centered little baby, you know, you've got to redirect them, and you've got to kind of shame them into it, because otherwise they ain't going nowhere.
So you think that your babysitting job with the Board of Stupid Vipers and the shitty councils are going to be effective in increasing from 1/8, I'm sorry, 1/10 of the homeless population of Salinas now to 1/8, and maybe one of these glorious days to 1/6?
It's called progress.
I suppose,
well, where are you, you know, I mean, what can we do right now? What are we doing? Well, I mean, we can give a meal right now, food, not bombs. But is
run around and babble about it, can't
I? Exactly, right? How far are you getting with it? You know, I mean, it takes all kinds, right? Certainly the people that I'm going to come in contact with and try to help, those people I'm going to try the most, because those are the only people I know. But I want to establish policy that goes further than that, and that's what you're asking about. You know, I can only go neighborhood at a time, dude, and same thing with vicinity. There might be 180 people here, 200 people getting a food lunch here, but it's still vicinity. You're not going to waste your whole day just to come and get a meal, you know, so we need more locations of these things all throughout, shelters, bathrooms. Just respect as people as people, you know.
Any prospects of a Salinas Food Not Bomb?
Well, they're growing legs. You know, they're crawling right now. They've already done a couple basic food giveaways. You know, of vegetable garden, fruits and vegetables. But actual cooked meals, they're not there yet because they don't have any kind of staffing or anything like that. Everybody's volunteer, but they've been doing it a lot longer as well.
So. You're a man who does travel significant distances to do a lot of video work, and your video is posted on YouTube. What's your most recent video?
Well, that forum is pretty recent. The California Coastal Commission, the Monterey Bay Community Power Potluck for Victory of Monterey Bay Community Power being a new renewable energy joint power association. To get us off of PG&E and all the profit that's in that will go to renewable energy construction.
Let's take a musical breather.
Johnny's mom and dad both worked long hours and they worked on the weekends too. Johnny was 11 but they had no notion of what Johnny was going through. Johnny got pushed and Johnny got robbed and they made him feel chicken to run. Big kids picked on Johnny every day till Johnny went and got him a gun. Johnny got a gun, he didn't bring it home, he covered it rags and dirt. On his way to school, he looked both ways and he hid it under his shirt. Johnny was afraid of going to school, there was always trouble in the hall. Fights in the boys' room, guns in the lockers, little kids bouncing off the wall. Johnny was afraid of dying young, everybody he knew had guns, so Johnny got a gun and never let things look cool. First time Johnny flashed his gun, everybody backed off fast. Everybody treated him differently there, Johnny felt safe at last. Johnny had a gun and everybody knew, and everybody left him alone. Till he bumped that kid who was coming down the stairs, and the kid had a gun of his own. Kid pushed Johnny, Johnny went down, and the kid had something to say. Pulled his gun, Johnny shot first, and they blew the other kid away. The police came and they took away the gun, said he wouldn't need a gun anymore. Took him to the station, sat him in a chair, and his feet didn't reach the floor. Johnny was afraid of dying young. Everybody he knew had guns, so Johnny got a gun and never let a bear look cool. Self-defense, prosecutor said no way. Judge said you're 11 but you kill like a man and it's gonna be a long, long stay. Johnny, mom and dad still work long hours and they knock on a unit door. They sit with Johnny in the visitor room and his feet don't reach the floor. Johnny was afraid of dying young. Everybody he knew had guns, said Johnny got a gun and every little thing looked cool. And his feet don't reach the floor.
Tom Paxton, Johnny Got a Gun. Now back to Wes White at Food Not Bombs.
You're forming many links with liberal groups.
Yeah, another guy, he's an Iraqi, and half Iraqi and Kurdish or something. And so, you know, yeah, his parents, and then he married a Catholic, so there's a lot of religious unity in that Nishwan Hamza. He's a pretty interesting guy.
Any of these people have anything to do with homeless people, or do they maintain a bourgeois separation?
Well, I suppose, but hard, hardly anybody wants to be friends with anybody. So, yeah, but
I've always hated you, you know.
I've always felt that from the beginning, absolutely.
Well, I try to be impartial in my hatred, you know.
Right? Yeah, there's nothing, it's not like I hate you specifically, I hate everybody the same.
Sounds like the police force that says, see, we don't just fuck you over, we fuck everyone over, which is fair and impartial.
Well, and yeah, there's that discretionary deal. You know, there was a piece in that discussion that I talked to you about, the new shelters opening, with cops going down the street, and they gave tickets one and another, and they met each other, and they said, yeah, I got three. How many you got? Oh, I got three. Okay. How about we go ahead and take off then, you know? So it seems to be quite harassing, and like I said, I think the more you point it out and the more people notice it, the awareness is first off, demonstrating it, that it actually did happen, and that's where the video comes in, quite honestly.
Have you been able to yet secure police records? I know you were having trouble doing that about a year ago.
Oh my, well, you know, it's not trouble, it's time, you know, time, effort, energy is
you had to pay for records and you couldn't photograph them and things of that sort.
Right, so my alternative was actually writing down everything.
My alternative was saying, I want to speak to the chief, and I want that in writing, and I want to, we got a couple people with me, this is an audio recorder, can you repeat that you will not allow me to video this? You know,
okay. All right, maybe I gave up too easy.
No. I'm not criticizing. I'm saying that that's one option. It requires, you know, you have to be able to stand up to thugs with guns and power.
Right. Well,
and that's actually what a number of us did a decade ago when we were trying to get together what Tricia Bauman and Abby Samuels and others are trying to do now, which is an injunction against the sleeping ban, perhaps another laws that criminalize the homeless. We were going after the sleeping ban with the aid of two attorneys, David Beauvais and Kate Wells. But we, in order to do that, we needed to get the records of people who had actually gotten citations or arrests, and we needed to do that and through the basement of the county building, which was at that time where you got your records. And they started throwing barriers in our way. They would only let us get our own records. And they wanted to charge us for the records. And then when they said, you can see somebody else's record, but we can only give you one at a time, and you'll have to wait to come back tomorrow for the next record. And our response to that was, we stood in line. When we got up to the window, we said, no, I'm here to get to see, as many records as you can make available now. And we're talking about microfiched records that are all in one place. They don't require a lot of special attention. But the point is, these are public records, or they're supposed to be public records available to the community. And they called the sheriffs in to demand we leave under threat of arrest. And we, with a video camera person there that we brought along, said, no, we're not leaving. We're waiting for our records. And the sheriffs backed off. The next time we did it, they had four sheriffs, as I remember, four or five, I'm not sure which. Next time they had two, next time they had one, but in each occasion, they backed off because we stood our ground. Now, that doesn't mean that would necessarily happen with Wes and Salinas and his attempt to take a picture with his camera or his video camera of the police records, because they want to charge him some absurd amount of money to get a record of the people that the police have been harassing with sleeping tickets and midnight wake-ups and property seizures. He might encounter problems, but it's really pretty clear that statewide he has a right to do that. And it's important, I think, to as much as you can assert your rights, and to do so in a way that you can document, so that it is not something that gets lost in the shuffle as you get shoved out. I've been shoved out of police stations when I came to file a complaint 25 years ago with a woman named Linda Edwards, called her Linda the Lark, about abuse by an officer named Sergeant St. Ange. Who had driven his car directly at us, I believe. The officer who was in the police station refused to take our complaint, and actually physically shoved us out of the old police station. So that can happen. I mean, and it's not necessarily that you want to put everything into every particular step that you are trying to take, but it is important to be aware that this kind of stuff can come up, and then you can deal with it in a flexible way, but it can't be a way where you are, I think a lot of the times, running to the sidelines, unless you really have a clear sense that that's a good strategy. I mean, there are some activists who do believe in, for example, not insisting on your right in Santa Cruz to set up a table on Pacific Avenue and register voters if the police tell you you can't do that, or you can only do it at a few very select locations, which may currently be taken up by musicians, panhandlers, vendors, or just other free speech people who want to speak, who are kind of crowding themselves into these little disc boxes. If you look, go to Pacific Avenue, you'll see areas where square areas or rectangular areas where there's a brass disc at each corner, and they're very small. Well, they're 2x3 squares long, indicating this is the only permitted zone where you can set up what's called a display device, which means a table, a cup, an open guitar case. It's a very targeted law. And, you know, the response of some people is to say, we've done this, we've set up tables and just stayed there. Huff, being we. Not recently, I've got to say, because Huff members recently, those of us who are still members of Huff, don't want to risk arrest. Very few people now these days, probably includes me, although I do occasionally do risk arrest, want to say, good, ticket me, arrest me, cite me. I don't, I'm not going to abandon my basic civil right just because you want to thug me into it. And I think it's time for another musical break.
Hallelujah, dads and mommies, cowboys, ripples, yanks, and commies, buy yourself some real red-blooded fun. If you want to make the grade, you've got to have a hand grenade and a fully automatic GI gun. Buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, play his weapon in his hand, for the skills he'll learn today will someday pay, sir. Pound that kid into submission till he's mastered nuclear fission. Buy him plastic warheads by the score. Once he's got the taste of blood, he's gonna sneak up on his buddy, starting his own thermonuclear war. Oh, buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, play his weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns they will someday pay, sir. Buy him khakis and fatigues and sign him up in little leagues and give him calisthenics as a rule. Once you've banished fear and dread, then pat his 7-year-old head and send him off to military school. Oh, buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns they will someday pay, sir. Once he's grown to be a man, he might get tired of blasting granny, then you'll see a crisis coming on. Don't get worried, don't get nervous, send that kid into service, let him ride into the Pentagon. At the Pentagon he'll ride, the president he will advise, his reputation growing all the while. With your picture on the wall, he'll get that long-awaited call and press the firing buttons with a smile. So buy a gun for your son right away, sir. Shake his hand like a man and let him play, sir. Let his little mind expand, place a weapon in his hand, for the skills he learns today will someday pay, sir.
And that was Tom Paxton again, Buy a Gun for Your Son, 1965 song. You are tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. This is a show recorded on August 3rd, 2017, but it is not live at the moment. It's being broadcast because we do not yet have a studio. Though, as I was mentioning earlier, chances are now looking very good for us. So if you want to actually beat out the offer that we're getting and earn $500 for finding us a studio, because that's the reward we're offering, call soon or go to freakradio.org. Freakradio.org is a place to go if you want to check out free radio or listen to it. There's archives of some of the shows of the programmers. There's application forms. There's information of different kinds. And it's kind of our central nexus. Call me. I'm not the official spokesperson for Free Radio, but I'm one of the broadcasters, 423-4833. So, guns. You know, I don't own a gun. I have friends who do, or they tell me they do. They never whipped out their guns to show them to me, but I believe them. But I haven't seen much gunplay in Santa Cruz by people I know or even have heard of much. Focus continues to be around the sanctioned use of guns by people in uniform. So, for instance, here's a story in the Chronicle from Ohio, Cincinnati. A judge on Monday dismissed charges against a white police officer who fatally shot an unarmed black motorist during a traffic stop after a county prosecutor declined to pursue a third murder trial in the case. Hamilton County Judge Leslie Giz declined to acquit former University of Cincinnati officer Ray Tensing in the shooting of Sam DeBose, but she did dismiss the murder and voluntary manslaughter charges in a way that blocks retrial on these counts. Two juries couldn't reach unanimous agreement on the charges, leading to mistrials. County Prosecutor Joe Dieters said he felt badly about dropping the case, but concluded he wouldn't be able to get a jury to convict Tensing. Tensing, now 27, shot the 43-year-old DeBose in the head after pulling him over for a missing front license plate on July 19, 2015. The shooting is among numerous cases nationwide that have called attention to how police deal with blacks, and it highlights the challenges prosecutors face in getting jurors to convict police officers for shootings when they say they're under threat. The officer, later fired, testified at both trials and said he feared he was going to be dragged or run over as DeBose drove away. DeBose's family and civil rights groups wanted a third trial. They now are hoping that federal authorities, good luck, reviewing the case will determine that DeBose's civil rights were violated. U.S. Attorney Benjamin Glassman said authorities will review evidence and so forth and so on. The university reached a $5.3 million settlement with DeBose's family, including free undergraduate tuition for his 13 children. Wow. I guess this was a university police officer. There was some university culpability. Again, it's like a buy-off. This is what I keep hearing or reading about, is the cities, instead of changing the policies about how they are going to allow their police officers to shoot to kill or get away with stuff or not face any meaningful consequences for violence and even murder, they pay off the victims. And that's what happens in Santa Cruz, too. Well, of course, you got to get a lawyer, and you got to be upper middle class, and you got to get some media. I mean, there's different requirements. But the reality is that nobody's made any safer by these kinds of payments necessarily, because there's no pressure put upon the police department, which is endlessly glorified. I mean, we've seen that in the case of former Sergeant Lauren Butch Sticky Fingers Baker, who was shot dead by somebody at a house along with his co-officer Elizabeth Butler. No angel either, as far as homeless people goes, in terms of my experiences with her and the accounts I received. I mean, Baker was a horrible officer in many ways. He was former attorney Ray Locke-Grunike testified he lied in court. I was aware myself that he had lied at different points. He was brought before city council on essentially claims that he had molested 10 women in inappropriate searches, which was dismissed by the city attorney and by the city manager at that time, and by, of course, the police department and the DA's office, claiming that no crime had been committed. But there's no attempt to reform the police department in a way that really responds to the community's needs. And I think that's still the case under our, particularly, I mean, not, it's no surprise that it's still the case under the new police chief, Andy Mills, who's coming in with a salary of $197,000 a year, according to the July 30th Sentinel, or Sentinel, as they call themselves. He talks about concerns of rampant drug addiction, including meth and heroin, petty theft, and property crimes, and citizens feeling unsafe in their homes and parks. Same story, city mangler or manager Martin Bernal said he met with diversity groups such as NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, before the hiring process to help shape the profile of a suitable police chief. Well, if that's the case, and it sounds like that's rather vaguely put, so obviously they probably weren't involved in any real consideration at a later, more formal step, the final step in the process of choosing Mills, who's from Eugene, and as I've, not from Eugene, he's from Eureka, sorry. He has, according to a recent memo he wrote up there to the city manager, pursued a policy of militant harassment of homeless people in Eureka, again, a city with similar shelter deficiencies to Santa Cruz and similar criminal penalties for homeless people simply trying to exist. I need to get back to the attorney who was defending homeless people many months ago, maybe even a year ago, as they were being run off the encampment area where they were living. But the notion that, again, we see the silence of the ACLU and the NAACP, which has access to these documents, or they should be aware of them. ACLU has access. Abby Samuels on the board of directors, as mentioned, and Keith McHenry recently published Andy Mills' four-page memo, which you can find on the Facebook page for Food Not Bombs or for Keith McHenry, indicating his violent attitude toward homeless people, or should we say repressive attitude. I guess if you can repress them without using overt force, provided they agree to disappear, that's fine. But the notion that it's this should be okay by the ACLU or the NAACP just shows you the kind of organizations they are. I mean, I've talked about the NAACP in our city never bringing forward a case of police abuse recently, or even in the past that I've heard of, maybe with an exception, one or two exceptions, but and I continue to mention this again and again, and I'll be mentioning it because I'm hoping we'll be able to confront Andy Mills, we being Huff, with not just his own past and his own practices up in Eureka, and demand that these not be repeated down here in Santa Cruz, but also the general institutional policies of the police department that he is joining, which have to do with shoot to kill, standard and daily discrimination against poor and homeless people in terms of selective enforcement of laws, political pressure for more criminalized laws, harassment of community organizations they don't like MHCAN, collusion with right-wing vigilante groups, the failure to have police officers live in the neighborhoods that they patrol, or even in the city that they patrol, no clear record and transparency on use of tasers, chokeholds, use of force, threat of force. There's a whole series of concerns that Huff has brought forward to the police department on a number of occasions in public protests around the time of the Ferguson murder of Michael Brown, for which the officer got away with it, and then later the SCPD murder of Sean Arlt, which happened last year, where he was shot dead. So Mills needs to not just be grilled, that's the police department, needs to be grilled. You put a new face on the police department, it's still the same old skull underneath. The thing he says in this article, or one of the things that he's quoted as saying, is we need to ensure officers feel safe. Because if the officers feel safe, they're less likely to shoot you. He didn't say it that. He said they're less likely to have to resort to lethal force. Now, what do we got? A bunch of gutless cowards and crybabies who are police officers, all armored up to go out with their Bearcats and their the video cameras that they can use essentially to doctor their own police reports. I mean, it's like you have an Imperial Guard, which is accountable to no one but sort of invisible higher-ups, and it vastly protected because of a strong police lobby. This, of course, is something that the city council isn't going to change, the city manager isn't going to change, the NAACP and the ACLU are not going to change. It's the city that's got to change. And then, of course, the most recent scandal around ICE, the Immigration Control and Enforcement Agency, where former police chief Vogel suddenly just acknowledged, I did have this ICE guy there for the last, 8 years in the department at a desk, but didn't explain why or how or what the guy was doing, or even reveal his correspondence on the date when the ICE agents were breaking down doors and dragging people out into the streets in Santa Cruz neighborhoods. It gets a little ripple. People come to city council and with rage at one moment actually stop city council, which is what they should do every city council meeting when this is not addressed, in which they should be at the police station doing the same thing, like Black Lives Matter has done. But it ain't happening at the moment, folks. Obviously, I need to calm down with another musical break. This one is decades old, but though U.S. troops aren't in Vietnam anymore because they were driven out by the Vietnamese, they're still all over the world and in expanding wars that have been growing continuously, and not just because Hillary Clinton didn't win the election or because because Trump is in power. They are, although it's getting worse that he's in power. But it's time for us to do what Pete Seeger suggests, to demand this, to get out and force this through whatever means we can.
If you love your Uncle Sam, bring him home, bring him home. Bring them home, bring them home. It'll make our general sad, I know. Bring them home, bring them home. They want a tango with the bow. Bring them home, bring them home. Here is their big palisade. Bring them home, bring them home. They'll have the right weaponry. Bring them home. Bring them home. The world's got hunger and ignorance. Bring them home. Bring them home. You can't beat that with bombs and guns. Bring them home. Bring them home. So if you love your Uncle Sam, support our boys in Vietnam. Bring them home. Bring them home. Now I may be right. I may be wrong. Bring them home, bring them home. But I got a right to sing this song. Bring them home, bring them home. Now there's one thing I will confess. Bring them home. I'm not really a pacifist. Bring them home, bring them home. If an army invaded this land of mine, bring them home. Bring them home, bring them home. Even if they drop their
with Pete Seeger, of course, Bring 'Em Home. It's back to a week and a half ago when I was chatting with Wes White at Food Not Bomb.
Any more energy? I mean, you know, just like, you know, these guys got a little bit burned out for a minute, and I guess there's some ebbs and flows, and I've been waiting for a little bit more backup. I've been doing most of it by myself, and, you know, you are quite an amazing fountain of energy, as you know. I mean, and the fact that, not just that you show up, which is good, but that you show up and come away with something that you later make available for broader distribution, I think is very important.
Absolutely right. Well, there's a lot of good things that can happen, and if you don't share what you got, how can you know? I can't share what I don't got, but I can share what I do got. And what I got is a lot of love, and I get that energy from a lot of other people. Actually, that's actually a healing part of my life. Seeing other people smile is what gives me that energy and drive. I feel compelled to do it because I don't want to see people cry.
Well, there's some people I'd like to see cry, actually, but that's another story. We've been talking with it before I go, though. Is there anything you want to add?
Well, you know, as much as you discount, I'm still going to go through with that. I'm going to get Andrew Pritchett and come down with Mike Zant, even. See if they might come down and just hopefully
strong. But they're strong voices. I just didn't approve what I heard. Abby relayed. I didn't listen to her whole thing. I just heard Abby describe the two suggestions she had, which has nothing to do with street organizing. You know, it has to do with attorneys and politicians.
Right.
And it's not that you shouldn't exclude.
And the suggestions are go to court with attorneys or talk to your local city council and organize there. Again, good suggestions for well-to-do people with a good connections, but not for poor people and ordinary people on the street. I mean, you can do it, provided you do a lot of other things that involve direct action, in my view.
Those methods, but that's not where you're going to get any power from.
And exactly, that's one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to get my Zent as well, and, you know, she was good enough to think of him as well.
And Zent is, you know, a very eloquent person. You may have heard him on my fine radio show at one time.
Sometimes.
Mike Zent is an activist who I have interviewed on this show, and he's very articulate. More important, he lives what he talks about. He's part of the First They Came for the Homeless encampment, which was raided and arrested and harassed, I think it's 15 or 16 times, but finally were left alone in their current encampment site on the border of Oakland and Berkeley, although I haven't heard much from them recently, so I'm hoping that's still the case. Mike Zent. Yeah.
But he's also, dare I say this, something of an elitist in the sense that, no, that's not entirely fair.
It's tough. You have to draw a boundary somewhere. And, you know, I think one of his boundaries was no drugs. And
right, well, no, I mean, it's true. Let me put it this way. His solution is an elite solution. And it has to do with excluding people who are unwilling to essentially cater to a middle-class lifestyle around them, who have to maintain, you know, a drug-free, alcohol-free scene. I guess alcohol-free, I'm not sure.
Right.
And all this stuff, which ordinary human beings do not have to do if they have a private place to go. And it's understandable why he would do this.
Right.
Because
yeah,
he needs, you know.
Yeah, too much.
Because it's a public scene, and he, for the same reason Brent Adams has a proposed sort of sanctuary village, which is, you know, seeks to get the approval of middle class people. Zen is a little less concerned with approval, but he is concerned with, I think, detoxing people and essentially creating a drug-free environment because of its toxic nature.
Well, if he's going to get into the realm of micromanaging people and just saying you ought not to do that or you shouldn't, you know, and wagging the finger, then you're just micromanaging somebody else's life. But if it's causing harm to the group, then that's something to be addressed.
Well, I think my point was that he has made a decision, or he had when I spoke with him about 4 or 5 months ago, as has his group, that they want to have, you know, their series of rather strict rules which, actually, I have no idea how strict they are because I don't live there, so I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, I think he's an excellent speaker, and I think he's done some good stuff. Ditto with Andrea, so I say, go West, go.
Thank you. Well, and if you wouldn't mind gracing us with your presence, you know, they would certainly...
Feel my oxygen over there, and away we'll go.
Suck it all down and suck it all out the room.
I have a stroke. Anyway, we've been talking with that man about Salinas activists, particularly activists on the street, of whom there aren't that many, but hopefully there'll be more.
Right, well, that's what we're trying to do, right? We got to sow the seeds, if you expect harvest.
And we're talking with the inimitable
Wes White.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Wes.
And that was Food Not Bombs. Week and a half ago, Saturday or Sunday, it was the 23rd of July. So now it's time for a little correspondence, and I'm going to read from a few emails I've gotten. Here's a couple recently arrived, actually in the last hour or 2 hours, from Coral Brune. She notes that the new police chief who we were talking about, or I was talking about, Andy Mills, gave an interview for 5 minutes on KZSC, which is the student station. He doesn't support giving homeless tickets out. A $200 ticket would make it worse on someone who's already strapped and makes it even more hopeless. That certainly sounds good, and I don't want to cut the poor man off at the legs without first examining, you know, what kind of body armor he's got underneath. But the real issue is, what about the substantive specifics of this? I mean, he can specifically note that he's making it the lowest priority. He can note that he is no longer using phony obstructing the sidewalk charges to go after protests that are indeed concerned with that very sleeping ban. And more important, the broader First Amendment right. This should be more important to bourgeois liberals like myself, people who are middle class, who want to have the right to protest without being shut down by police, provided our protest remains nonviolent, although there are many who believe that ultimately you're going to need violent protests as well on these situations. Well, if you want to get fundamental change and overcome existing power structures, that's, of course, been what others have said as well, and it's something you need to consider. But, you know, at least he could take action to pull back the clear repression of nonviolent people that has been taking place over the last few years, both activists and homeless folks. And I guess I'll probably bring that up at the next tough meeting, or maybe before. Maybe I'll just send him an email saying, you know, let's have an interview and see if you're willing to make any commitments. And that would be nice. Although I've heard commitments before from people who actually are more liberal in their origins and their connections, like Sandy Brown, the city councilwoman. But once they get into power, they get lost, or they change their opinions, or it turns out you are dealing with smoke and mirrors. And I've talked about Sandy, the problems with Sandy before, namely that she's promised to provide, at least to make an effort to get public records that she's refused to do. Or not refused, that she just forgets to do or won't talk about anymore. And that's her way of avoiding it. Coral Brune, who's an activist and an artist, also notes that Andy Mills supports cannabis, but it has to be put to the public vote. And he says he won't cooperate with ICE at all. That's nice, but we need to have a clean bill of health as to what's actually happened in the police department in the past under Vogel. Because if Vogel is guilty of violating the city policies, the community needs to know about it in the most clear way. And we need to see the documentation indicating Vogel says one thing, the guy who's the ICE, Department of Homeland Security guy, says another. Who's telling the truth? You know, how closely, cheek by jowl was the police department with the ICE when they smashed in doors and provided squad cars to hold innocent people whose only crime is having been here with paper violations and immigration violations? I know, they're all M13 gang members. Yeah, yeah, that was the cover story. Also, Coral wonders if we could ask Andy Mills if he could get credit or money for giving back the Bearcat. Not a bad idea, though a very whimsical one. And also, Coral has some concerns about the library, and she writes about that. She writes about what's going on at the downtown library in Santa Cruz. First, she suggests it's more and more like a cafe or an internet cafe, usually people talking and somewhat trashy on a level that no other people really want to hear. That goes for the staff also helping, which is a little understandable, but I've seen staff, and here we go, throwing people out who are quietly listening to music with their eyes closed, not even addressing when people are talking loudly at the computers. So why is it you can't listen to music with your eyes closed and your earbuds on? And it's to avoid the asleep appearance, I know, but what are the other standard behaviors not tolerated? Like pulling out certain items that seem undesirable, a little unclear what she means. Some may be medicines, but in any case, it would be nice to have somebody keep an eye on what's going on in the library. We actually, at one time, Huff paid a lot of attention to that. And if we ever get more resources, more people involved, we might again. Library is traditionally a place where homeless people come to for as a kind of a refuge during the day. And, of course, it's now been made a crime to be outside the library after the library is closed. If I have that right, I think it's okay until 9:30 at night, but I think they may be also duplicating what the city is doing over at City Hall, which is making it a crime to be anywhere in the City Hall grounds after city offices close, which is never the case in the past and has no justification other than running away protesters. Pretty bad stuff. I'm going to jump back a month or more to an interview I did by phone with activist Dan McMullen of Berkeley. And hopefully it will speak for itself.
Okay, well, I'm on the line with Dan McMullen, a Berkeley activist of no mean sort, who's, today is Wednesday the 14th of June, and you've been sort of hopping from campground to campground, kind of addressing issues. What's going on with the accommodation section of campgrounds in Berkeley?
We've got a number of camps around Berkeley now. There's one really nice camp down, and I say nice because, like, there's solar panels and there's grass and it's kind of spread out and it's very clean and it's right underneath the freeway, which is not a great location because of the freeway, but it's a place where you'll be left alone, and it's like right by the University Avenue Bridge in Berkeley, and I've been doing some work down there with folks. And then there's another up on what's the name of that street? Virginia Street and around 2nd, and that's kind of dusky, and it's like, you know, Dodge City in its gritty heydays. It's pretty dusty, and there's like a big asphalt plant next to it. And surprisingly enough, that's where our new city council, Berkeley City Council, our new spanky, clean, progressive city council, wants to build this new, I can't think of the name of the camp they want to build. It's got a name, something center or something, but they want to build a camp there, which would be like these tents on platforms and a number of those, and right next to the asphalt company. And if anything, I would like to move those people to a more helpful kind of area for a camp and get rid of that asphalt company, or get rid of the asphalt company, one of the two. I'd really like to see them get rid of that asphalt company, because we've been trying to get rid of that for years. It's not only killing the homeless people that live next to it, but it's killing half of Northside Berkeley. That's the highest carcinogen area in all of the Bay Area on the east side.
Wow. And
so, we're in an area that has refineries in Richmond and the port, which is below the Pacific Steel and Berkeley Asphalt in carcinogens in the air.
So have the police been using 647E and other criminal codes to go after homeless campers?
There's been, it's been kind of quiet lately, but I'm getting the feeling like they want to start to ramp things up again. The camp over there with the first day came for their fellow homeless, it's been going on for a number of months now, and they've been pretty much left alone, but I see it things starting to crack around the edges over there, too. I keep track of them from afar.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I have a couple people in the camp that keep me up on what's going on. There's somebody that really needs help, and I'll meet them down the block and take them out somewhere, but I don't really like to have much to do with the camp. Not because of the people, but just a couple of people that are, think they run the place over there. So kind of beyond the pale.
So are the, is there much unity with the camp, between the camps? I mean, I know there were different...
No, none at all, really, which is kind of sad. I don't know what the problem is with the unity. It's just mostly space. They're pretty spread out. And there's different philosophies for the different camps.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Anything happening over in San Francisco worth noting?
All I know is what my friends have been telling me. There's been to different things over there, but I haven't been over there for about a month.
I guess I'm going to leave it there then. I've been a little out of commission myself. Unless it's something you want to add.
No, not at all. Nothing I can think of. We're just chucking along here. It's been kind of slow and lazy for the last couple of weeks, but we did have one really weird incident I want to mention, and that was this girl who supposedly fed methamphetamine to a toddler in People's Park. That was this big thing that happened up here. I don't really trust the whole mechanism there. First of all, I want to mention that there's no, like, the people that have the hardest times on the street with mental illness and things like that, there's no help for them whatsoever in our area. There's no real outreach. There's no prevention. The only time they do anything is when the person actually assaults somebody, and then they lock them up. But they don't do anything when they're having issues before that. And I'm just talking about, helping people out, getting them into a room, doing any kind of humane intervention. None of that's happening. And then, I know firsthand, I have a family member that is on the streets with mental illness, and we can never get that person any help whatsoever. And if they do give her any help, it's only for like a day or two, and then they're back in the same position they were before, and it's just this complete roller coaster where there's no real hope in sight for these people. And recently, like last week, supposedly there was a woman in the park with she was a nanny with a toddler, and it's alleged that this woman came up to her, and I've known the woman in the park for a long time now, the woman came up to the toddler, put methamphetamine in the toddler's mouth, and that just spread all over the place. And it just I just find it really interesting that that happens right when the university is talking about taking the park and making it into housing for students.
And is that happening now? Or?
Well, it's one of like 8 locations they have on their list. And even the fact that they would think about taking the only green space on the south side and turning it into another kitty condo where they have almost own all the property, half the property in Berkeley already, and pay no taxes, and, you know, are responsible for running the park into the ground. The park was much, much better and well taken care of when it belonged to the city. A lot of it's back in the university's hands. It seems to me like their plan is to make it as horrible as possible so they can justify turning it into a moneymaker.
Gotcha. Well, look, we appreciate the update. I'm pooped and tired and unable to give you the full force of my critique. So I'm gonna
I hear you there. So I'm going to leave it at that, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan McMullen.
I haven't gotten back to Dan McMullen in a month and a half. I'm going to have to do that soon. But I'm going to read from a couple of stories in Berkeley now. Here's an article from a website I've never seen before. Sefero.org Counterpoints by J. Douglas Allen Taylor. News, folkism, discussion, and argument like you used to get over the counter at the corner store. And it's called The Healthlessness of Homelessness. And it was written July 25th or posted July 25th on 2017. The good news is that Oakland appears to have finally turned our attention to the crisis of homelessness in the city. The bad news is that the impetus for much of this new urgency to do something about the problem is an odd coalition of those who want to help the homeless and those who want to get rid of them, coalescing around a growing concern to eliminate those homeless camps and tent cities along our streets, in our vacant fields and lots and frontage roads, either to eventually get their residents into shelters first and then permanent housing, or else to get these devils hence, to borrow from Cousin Matthew, either out of the city or just out of sight. But the fact is, even though the homeless camps and tent cities have only recently entered the consciousness of most Oakland residents, they're the product of complex social forces that have been building for decades and continue to build and press against our social fabric. To try to get rid of these camps and tent cities is like trying to mop the water off the bathroom floor without turning off the faucet that caused the bathtub to overflow in the first place. You can mop all you want, the water will continue to flow until the tap is turned shut. Unfortunately, the tap of social forces that created and continues to create more homeless in Oakland cannot be fixed by some simple twist of hand and metal. Absent a cataclysmic intervention by some major outside forces, such as the World War that put America to work and pulled its economy out of the Depression of the 1930s, ending the forces that created Oakland's current homeless crisis is going to take some thought, some careful planning, and more than a few decades of hard work that will certainly go past the lifelines of many of the people reading this piece. So just like with open-air drug markets or prostitution strolls, the most pressing call from any community, and the one that often gets translated directly to action by the politicians who represent that community, is to get them off my corner. Actually, getting a tent city or homeless camp removed from any given location is easily done. Police clear out the tent city at 85th International about once every 3 or 4 weeks on a regular schedule. After posting a warning notice several days in advance, the police stand around while city workers pile discarded belongings and trash into trucks, and then a fire truck comes by to use its hoses to wash away whatever residue is left behind on the streets. The camp residents wait around the corner with their preferred stuff in shopping carts and garbage bags, and when the operation is completed and the police and city workers have all left, return to reoccupy the spot they've only temporarily vacated. Come back within an hour and you would never know that a city cleanup and evacuation operation ever took place. Unless, of course, they set up a barbed wire or chain link fence around it, or destroy all the grass as was done at the Santa Cruz City Hall, or regularly patrol it with a lot of either armed or empowered thugs to harass people who are trying to get together in a community to sleep and support each other, or at least get out of the cold and the wind and the rain. A little addition. But continuing with the article about Oakland and Berkeley, clearing up a particular site permanently requires a lot more effort and expenditure of city resources, but is doable. The problem is, without a comprehensive plan and program for an overall homeless solution, permanently clearing a peculiar site or corner only means driving the homeless folks to another site or corner until they reach one where the community is less organized or less persuasive, the politicians less pressed, and therefore where the problem squats and stays. Don't much like his language, but reading on. In other words, there is no quick fix to the homeless camps in tent cities, if by that you mean driving them away. And not until we reach an ultimate solution as to what is causing these settlements to spring up in the first place. But while we are working on long-term solutions, there is an immediate crisis that can be solved in the short term and must be addressed and attacked now for the good of us all. And that is the crisis of uncollected waste growing out of the homeless camps. It is the crisis that threatens the health of every citizen of the city of Oakland. And I guess this is my longer article, which you can find online under the phrase "the healthlessness of homelessness," and suggests regular pickups and waste disposal. And it's pretty obvious. I've suggested that here in Santa Cruz for homeless camps here, but it's considered by those criticizing it as enabling, and therefore you don't want to do that. It's like somehow providing clean needles is enabling rather than it's a health measure, which is actually harm reduction. So, yeah, he's looking for, looks like he's looking for ways of disposing of trash through regular pickups, whether we're talking about bathrooms or porta-potties. Make portable toilets available at every established tent city and homeless camp in the city and operate a system to maintain them and keep them clean. Second, establish a regular weekly system of garbage disposal in every established tent city and homeless camp in the city using the regular closable hard plastic containers that every Oakland residence has rather than plastic bags. Third, establish a regular city and county sponsored program of health inspections and mitigations in the tent cities and homeless camps, including health-oriented treatments for the folks living in them, not as an excuse to shut them down, which we've already established as a fruitless endeavor in the short run, but as a way to make them healthier places for the people living there. Shouldn't be a substitute for a program to end the conditions that created the homeless camps and tent cities in the first place, but can and should be done while we're working on that long-term solution. And that's Jesse Allen Taylor and his Counterpoints article. I'm going to play a few tributes to singer Phil Oakes, who I've played many times on my show over the years. And we'll begin with one of his songs and then take it from there. Oakes killed himself in 1975 or 76 in his garage.
Singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone. All the pleasures of love will not be mine when I'm gone. My pen won't pour a lyric line when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't breathe the bracing air when I'm gone. And I can't even worry about my cares when I'm gone. Won't be asked to do my share when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be running from the rain when I'm gone. And I can't even suffer from the pain when I'm gone. Can't say who's to praise and who's to blame when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. Won't see the golden of the sun when I'm gone. And the evenings and the mornings will be one when I'm gone. Can't be singing louder than the guns while I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. All my days won't be dances of delight when I'm gone. And the sands will be shifting from my sight when I'm gone. Can't add my name into the fight while I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be laughing at the lies when I'm gone. And I can't question how or when or why when I'm gone. Can't live proud enough to die when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone. And I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it. I guess I'll have to do it. Guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.
That was When I'm Gone. Here's Dave Von Ronk. He was a friend of mine live at the Phil Oaks Memorial Concert, singing his tribute to Phil Oaks. About a week ago, a little more, a couple days after I was researching the, after the what would have been Freedom Sleep Out 107, that would be last July, Tuesday, I went down to see if anybody had stayed the night, because I'd heard that, well, I found out that there were people providing food and drink. Tyler of Food Not Bombs and Joe Schultz of the India Joe's restaurant had come by to do that. I wanted to find out if anybody actually stayed the night. I found that nobody had. This was a Tuesday a week ago, and I got a similar story, sort of, from Tuesday, day before yesterday, and what would have been Freedom Sleep Out 108. But here's an interview with Tyler, who was manning the soup bucket, and this was, I guess this was the day after. It was July 26th, or no, manning the coffee urn. The soup bucket had come and gone the night before.
For the update.
Darkness, I don't wish upon anybody.
You're there. I mean, you're here. And I'd ask who we've been talking to, but I'm not going to.
This is a previous interview.
Ask you, but maybe next time you'll feel more comfortable, because I know you've often spoken on the record before.
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
Thank you,
God bless. Tyler.
And Tyler, I see you have what looks like a Joe Schultz's coffee urn here, and a nice half-and-half crate, and a cup of coffee in your hand.
Yeah.
What's been happening?
Not a whole lot. We got some coffee out here for people, and they have been so far somewhat coming out and drinking it.
No hassles from rangers, cops?
Probably too small, no.
And you were also here last night?
Yeah, with soup.
About what time did that happen?
About 6 o'clock I got here and stayed until around 8:30.
And how many folks would you estimate were fed?
15.
And what was significant about that was Tyler actually spent his, I'd heard that he had spent nights at City Hall as a freedom sleeper in the weeks before, but then when the police cracked down with obstructing the sidewalk tickets, essentially driving everyone away, and really prompting Abby Samuels, one of the main organizers, to encourage people not to come back because she felt there was really no way of effectively defending against citations in court, though many people just use their tickets as trash anyway. But in theory, they can be held accountable. And indeed, we had an activist and a Huff member who had come to the Huff meeting yesterday who talked about wanting to challenge her ticket in court, and it is apparently true that Abby Samuels will, and Food Not Bombs will make available a person, I don't know whether it's Abby or Food Not Bombs, but if you get in touch with Food Not Bombs and talk to Abby a day in advance, she or someone will come down and help you try to sort out tickets if you want to deal with going through the labyrinthine court process down there. I've talked a lot about the court process over the years, and you're welcome to call me too if you'd like. I won't be coming down to help, but I can try to provide my own thoughts by phone. But I understand from what I've heard from Cherie, who is an activist who's been, she was with the Survival Sleepers night after night at City Hall after the winter shelter program closed down, and then with the Freedom Sleepers, when the Survival Sleepers were driven away, the Freedom Sleepers came only on Tuesday nights, and then when they were driven away, she got two tickets anyway, but she just didn't want to go back and get, as she put it, another $300 ticket. But she was at the Huff meeting yesterday, and just sort of as a quick aside, the Huff meeting sort of pretty much finalized a letter supporting MHCAN, that's a Mental Health Client Action Network, which is a group under strong attack by right-wing forces involving the police, real estate developer, nosy or bigoted neighbors, and right-wing activist organizations that want to see the homeless out of sight, if not out of town. And we got together a letter which, in essence, is directed to Mayor Cynthia Chase, as well as other authorities, Planning Commission, Board of Supervisors. But it asks Chase specifically to put on the agenda of City Council a real discussion of the issue of MHCAN, the attacks on MHCAN, to look at expanding its services, to look at restoring, actually, its services. They've been cut back to 50 clients a day. Yeah, from the 150 to 200 they were serving reportedly a year or two or three ago. But in any case, this is more about, we're looking, we're listening to interviews from the, right across from the City Hall Library, and from, I guess this is the morning after what would have been Freedom Sleepout 107. The Freedom Sleepout would have taken place a week and 2 days ago, and Tyler is talking about, he apparently had also not heard of anybody staying overnight, but he was still coming back to provide food to the people who came in the morning and who came in the evening, even if they didn't stay the night. And I heard some mixed reports that people were still continuing to show up there, but I did not hear that from anyone who directly had been there or had seen someone there. So let's hear a little more from Tyler before we fade into the sunset.
16th. And how was it for you? Interesting, boring, tedious, exciting?
Really, not a whole lot of drama. No cops, just one little thing here between two friends, I'm guessing, or possibly acquaintances. But other than that, no, people were cool, and we got through it all right.
Wow. How many people would you say slept the night?
No one. I can't say as far as I know. I got here. I left about 8:30, and came here around 7:30 at night. So could have been
7:30 in the morning.
7:30 in the morning. Yeah. So could have been any number. I'm not sure.
And when you got here, there were people here.
No, I was the only one here.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they had perhaps folks cleared out. Were you here last night?
No. I come to about half of them. I wasn't here last night. It seems like this movement itself has lost a lot of steam, and I don't know. It's a lot mellower. It's not like when we were first out here and they had the light generators and it was really aggressive. It was almost a combat scene, you know. It seems.
Yeah, the city was going after us. Of course, now they've made it illegal to be in most of the areas.
Well, yeah, which is bullshit, and they spent a shitload of money to do that. Like, look at it. Remember this is Lawn?
Yeah, I do.
Why is it like, you know, they didn't do it to make it look more beautiful or to make it, they just did it to drive people out. They shut the bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. They took out the drinking fountains. They took away their own, like.
Well, we can't have you hanging around, man. Come on.
We don't, we don't want you to use it, so we're going to take it out, even though we use it.
Yeah.
You know, that
well, they have their own private little bathrooms in the back.
Inside and shit, yeah.
Right.
So, and what's going on right now? Why are they taking out all the trash cans on Pacific Avenue? I have a problem with people trashing this town, and now they're taking off all the trash cans. I almost can't blame people for littering.
Oh, yeah, well, what are you going to do if there's no trash cans?
I mean, come on, like, you got to have some trash cans around, dude, right?
Where did you spend the night, if you want to say?
Last night, a friend of mine rented a hotel room, and I stayed over at his place. But I camp out all over town.
Ever spend time at the post office?
A little bit, not too much, but yeah. I go to Food Not Bombs on the weekends a lot.
And you got a report of difficult times at the post office last night from a woman who was there. But I understand that's where people have kind of migrated to, or some folks anyway.
Yeah, that's a pretty heavy area. There's a lot of drug use going on there. A lot of really dirty people there. I don't know. I don't like that area right now. It's a beautiful place, but I don't like that area right now.
Ever use the library much as a daytime facility at all? Or?
I do once in a while. I use the computer so once or twice a week, maybe.
How do they treat you?
No problems.
That's good.
I also don't give them shit, dude. I don't fucking start talking to myself and yelling and then carrying in a ton of shit and eating food at the computer when they tell you not. You know what I mean? People are asking to get harassed at the library most of the time.
Have you seen much harassment for people sleeping in the library?
Yeah, I've seen. I don't. You're not supposed to sleep in the library. You're supposed to sleep in the park. It's a library. You're not supposed to be loud. Any library you've ever been to, you're not supposed to make noise. People start making noise, they ask them to leave.
Like loud snoring, that sort of thing.
No, like talking. Snoring, okay. It not really. But in what public places? What business? I mean, not that the library is a business, but where can you sleep in somebody's place where it's not for sleeping? It's a library.
Well, traditionally across the country, it's not that they have cots in the library, but it's been a place where homeless people, excluded from elsewhere, usually can somehow go to be, as you know, and it's...
To sleep during the day?
Not necessarily, but that can happen. Illegal to sleep at night, you know.
I can see somebody falling asleep. You know, I get that. You know, I've fallen asleep in the library before. But if they wake you up and you can't stay awake, I don't know what you do. You can't just sleep in the library.
You can't sleep outside because the guards are walking around. You can't sleep over here because...
You can sleep outside during the day when the library's open. You can go sleep in the parks. Nothing against sleeping in the parks, other than you're not supposed to maybe be covered up or some bullshit, you know?
Well, it depends on the mood of the rangers, I think. I mean, it depends on whether they're... I, for example, heard tell of at Laurel Park, you know, right next to Loudon Nelson Center.
Yeah, I go there quite often.
The guy who lives across the street tells me that he has seen rangers just come and stand over people sleeping in the park during the day. They doesn't tell them to leave. He just stands over them. Now, that's what drives them away.
Loudon Nelson is kind of a special park. I love the Loudon Nelson Center in general, man. That guy was a hero, Loudon Nelson himself. Anyway, there's a lot of kids at that park, young kids. It's a small park. That's where you have to watch, is that back area. You do have some unruly people around kids. There needs to be security there.
But unruly sleepers who are trying to rest them.
Those sleepers get up, and some of them are weird, man. And they all. I'm not saying that the guard does it every day. He stands out there in the same spot. Everybody knows who goes to that park, where he stands. If you're going to sleep right there, then he's going to stand over you. You could sleep on the other side of the park. He doesn't go and seem to chase you.
Well, that's the question. So he's, according to what I've told, on two occasions, he's seen a person, a ranger, go and stand over someone.
Well, the rangers are different than the security that works.
Yeah, they're a different group.
Yeah, and I don't like the whole ranger thing at all.
You and me both. And we've been talking with...
I'm Jake. Jake, Jack Diamond, Bumper Man. Oh, shit, I just gave up my alias, Bumper Man.
Watch out, guys. And keep B on the lookout.
You remember the skateboard with the bumper on it?
I do not.
Oh, he was awesome. Anyway.
Let me leave it there. Unless you want to conclude with something?
No. I love this town. It's a beautiful place. Don't trash it. But
don't treat people like trash if you don't want people to trash it. And provide trash cans is what I'd say.
That part, too, you got a little point there. But don't trash this place. It's a special place. And
thank you, man.
And you guys have too much money.
Right. Free radio. And that was about 9 days ago. Hopefully I'll have more interviews in the days ahead of a more revealing nature, perhaps. I'm going to kind of conclude here with a story in the Berkeley Daily Planet, which is an online occasional newspaper. It's regular, actually, a regular paper. A story by activist and singer Carol Denny, also writer, of course, who regular listeners may remember has been on the show a number of times, and her songs have been on the show for decades. She wrote a story, The Latest Unregulated Compliance Tool, and it goes as follows. The earliest descriptions of pepper spray and taser's utility as a useful police tool implied, erroneously, that they would work safely and immediately render suspects docile and compliant. When subsequent studies proved that both pepper spray and tasers not only did not produce uniform effects on people, but were lethal for an unidentifiable ratio of the public, the search for a compliance tool by weapons manufacturers interested in the lucrative police market went on. Tuesday, July 25th, 2017, around 3 in the afternoon, a group of us working at Expressions Art Gallery suddenly heard very loud screaming. We walked outside to the northeast corner of Ashby and Shattuck near the bank and saw several police officers surrounding and forcing a blonde white man face down on the sidewalk. As he screamed, already handcuffed, the officers bound him in some kind of leg restraints and then forced him into a kind of white hood, which they put over his head. He kept screaming while they completely bound him in restraints. In full view of the public, which took a lot of struggle and time, he kept asking for help. We don't know what took place before the screaming, but it had been a very peaceful sunny afternoon at the gallery, and on the part of Ashby where we were working. We checked with the bank on the corner. At least 4 police cars and 5 or 6 police officers took the man away, and there had been no disturbance there. We were all very shaken up. The Expressions Gallery director and I watched along with several bystanders. We saw 2 badges, an Officer Rodriguez and an Officer Martinez, but we didn't get any additional badge names or the names of the victim. All of us felt the restraints were making the situation much worse for everyone. After the man was picked up and put in the police car, the officers laughed together, and one of them, an Asian officer, excitedly claimed that the man had tried to bite him, which was not apparent to any of us. It was chilling that they seemed to have no awareness of how frightening the application of restraints was for the man they had forced to the sidewalk, as well as for all of us who were watching. We don't know who he was. The man who was restrained needed any witnesses. It was all we could think to do was to watch in horror. The officers claimed they could not tell us what had happened, and while there might be privacy constraints, it seemed absurd that no information whatsoever was offered in the light of the use of the strange hood and the restraints. There seemed to be no awareness among the officers of the severe personal humiliation for the man in restraints and the horror for us as bystanders left to wonder, as the police cars sped away, what in the world would warrant such treatment. It is frightening to think that if one of us cries out in anguish or fear as one is arrested, the restraint system might become routine. We had trouble the rest of the day getting the incident out of our minds. We can't imagine that this is necessary. The Expression Gallery is the loveliest place to wander through, full of ideas, excitement, and color. The gallery has poetry readings, classes for adults, events for children, and art openings with live music and a feeling of lively neighborhood and professional exchange. That afternoon, it was robbed of its unique sense of peace and exploration, and none of us can understand why. There's apparently no policy in Berkeley governing the use of what is apparently called a split hood, accompanying restraints, unless the wording following is clear to you. Quote, General Order 1406 number 2 states, it shall be the policy of this department to handcuff and otherwise effectively restrain all arrested persons, excluding infraction citations where no transport is necessary, or detainees as reasonably necessary to protect the lives and safety of officers, the public, and the person arrested.
The general order continues with number 3, quote, use of a full or partial body restraint system, the WRAP, ankle restraint systems, ambulance gurney with 5-point straps. While initial use of handcuffs behind the back and hands-on control techniques may be necessary for officer safety, if circumstances dictate greater care should be taken during transportation, supplemental restraint devices and/or alternative transportation options should be considered. In deciding whether restraint of a person's hands behind her back will aggravate a physical disability, injury, or obvious state of pregnancy, the officer should consider the totality of circumstances, including observable signs of disability, partial paralysis, convulsive seizure activity, medic alert ID, disabled person placard, etc. 2, statements of the person or others regarding the person's condition. And 3, indications the person is at significant risk of positional asphyxiation. The spokesperson from Safe Restraints, the manufacturer, described the system as very comfortable and magical in terms of its utility in quickly and safely restraining combative, threatening individuals, adding the system was designed only for situations where there is danger to the suspect, to the individuals, or to officers. The WRAP restraint was first deployed in 1996 and has been used by Berkeley Police for about 10 years. The origin of this restraint system, according to writer Maddie Simpson of the science-based website Modern Notion, is in the psychiatric wards of mental hospitals in the form of wet sheet packs. Simpson states the WRAP, a design by a company called Self Restraints, Inc., has a few separate pieces that clip together to hold the prisoner. An ankle wrap keeps the prisoners from kicking, a blanket-like leg wrap tightens around the prisoner's legs, and a chest harness tightens around their chest. After all the parts are properly put on, the chest harness is attached with a chain to a piece on the legs, locking the captive in the sitting position. This article continues, originally a branch of hydrotherapy, wet sheet packs were sheets dipped in varying temperatures of water and wrapped around the patient tightly. The thought behind the treatment was to exclude all air from inside the pack so that a patient's body would sweat out colds. The therapy was also aided in the treatment. It also aided in the treatment of rheumatism, but the wet packs were being used as mechanical restraints, just as common as they were used for therapy. The wet pack was so commonly used as restraint in 1873, they were defined no longer as therapy, but as a form of restraint and lost popularity thereafter. Safe Restraints Inc. makes the same claim, originally used about pepper spray and tasers, that the WRAP is easy to apply, safe to use, and creates immediate compliance. But that isn't what those of us watching on Ashby Avenue saw on July 25th. We saw a prolonged, exhausting struggle for all parties, humiliating and debilitating treatment of a captive as yet not convicted of any crime. Whether or not this exotic restraint system is necessary is, according to the Berkeley Police Department's current guidelines, a matter determined by ambiguous decisions of the officer or officers at the scene using words like reasonably necessary and determinations of positional asphyxiation, which most physicians agree cannot be determined solely by observable physical features. There appears to be no mention of the hoods or any set of restrictions for their application. The additional effect for those of us who are workers, neighbors, and passers-by simply observing what happened was chilling. We have no idea what in the world would constitute appropriate use of a restraint system which requires a 15-minute physical struggle by at least 4 officers who seem to regard the application of the WRAP restraint in and of itself a significant victory when they were done. The application of the hood removed the captive completely, made him completely anonymous, a hooded figure such as one might see in the photographs of Guantanamo. According to Simpson, the company's website boasts no deaths or injuries in 19 years of use. But in 2000,